This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Here in the now, we live above the shadows.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, and what a show we have for you this week. Arnie Gunderson covers the world's worst nuclear dangers, from the ongoing poisoning of the Pacific Ocean by the meltdowns at Fukushima, Japan, to America's disaster in waiting right in California. Arnie releases some new information about the nuclear danger right here on Radio EcoShock. Oh yeah, and the nuclear plume is hitting the West Coast right now. Then we'll talk through the battle of capitalist profits versus the climate and all of nature. Our guest will be Naomi Klein, author of the new book, This Changes Everything. Ready, set, go. In early October, two typhoons swept over Japan. The TV showed flooding in Tokyo, but they forgot to mention the nuclear disaster site at Fukushima. The worst flash floods, up to 10 inches of rain, were predicted for Fukushima Prefecture, where three blown reactors already leak 300 tons of radioactive water into the Pacific on a good day, each and every day. We're going to get an update on Fukushima, the mess there, from our favorite correspondent, Arnie Gunderson. He's a former nuclear industry executive who now gives expert testimony on reactor safety. His videos on the website, fairwinds.com, are the best anywhere. Arnie, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. It's been quite a while.
It has been a while, but it's time to get Fukushima back into the news. You know, as we know, it's like curse that keeps on giving day after day and, well, year after decade. And I want to get the latest on that. Then we should talk about the possible Fukushima in waiting right in California. I know you have a new report on the Diablo Canyon reactors. But let's start with this underreported or even unreported news about the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex right on the east side of Japan. There were two typhoons in a row, Fanfone and Vongfong. What have you heard?
Well, let's go back to the week that the accident began 3 years ago. When the cores melted down, the nuclear containments were really not designed for the temperature and the high radiation that they experienced. So what happened was all of the rubber seals that allow electric wires to go in and out and that allow the pipes to go in and out, all of those rubber seals failed. So even though the nuclear reactor core didn't melt through the concrete, what happened is that the groundwater is coming in through the holes in the walls. So for the last 3 years, there's been, as you said, 300 tons of water passing through that nuclear reactor and out into the Pacific every day. So the problem was in effect back a month after the nuclear accident occurred. And there were things they could have done back then. I recommend it, pumping down the groundwater, but between the pumps and the nuclear reactor, having something called a zeolite trench. Zeolite is a really good material. It's volcanic, that would capture all of the radioactive cesium and most of the other isotopes. Well, I was told 3 years ago that Tokyo Electric didn't have the money. Well, it's one of those pay me now or pay me later. Because they didn't keep that groundwater under control 3 years ago, now they're paying the price. So these typhoons come along and dump, as you said, 10 inches of rain, an enormous amount of rain in a very short time. And in addition to the 300 tons that's normally leaking in, now there's a lot more. So all of the trenches that connect different parts of the plant are now overflowing and leaking into the ground as well. You know, when you compare Fukushima to Chernobyl, the total release of radioactivity from Fukushima is worse than the total release from Chernobyl. Chernobyl may have released 20 or 30% more into the air, but this ongoing leak of radioactivity into the groundwater never happened at Chernobyl. So we've got the plant is continuing to bleed directly into the Pacific day in, day out. And whenever you get an excessive rainfall, essentially it pops an artery and flows even more hundreds of tons into the Pacific. And it's not a problem that's going to go away. After Chernobyl, a year after Chernobyl, they had pictures of the nuclear reactor core. And a year and a half after TMI, Three Mile Island, they had pictures of the reactor core. Well, Fukushima is so radioactive, no one's gotten near it yet. We don't even know where this nuclear reactor core is, let alone try to stop it from leaking into the groundwater. It's a real mess. It could have been mitigated 3 years ago, but, you know, they're saying the horse is out of the barn now and you're not going to get it back. Tokyo Electric was penny wise and pound foolish. There were chances to stop this in the first month, and they just didn't do it.
And we know, Arnie, that TEPCO has been pumping hundreds of tons of highly radioactive water to storage tanks on the site, and that's pumped from the area around the reactor cores, even though we don't know where they are, and from the area generally. Now, the Japanese have repeatedly warned they're running out of storage. Did they dump some of that water into the Pacific?
Well, they are running out of storage if you limit their storage space to the site. But right over the fence boundary is totally uninhabitable land, too. So if they really wanted to, they could extend these tank farms into land that's adjacent to the plant. Politically, they don't want to do that. They want to start dumping water as opposed to capturing water. The biggest problem, in my mind, with these tanks, there's two problems. First off, if there's another severe earthquake, a Richter 7, not the Richter 9 that was off the coast, but a Richter 7, all of these tanks are not seismically qualified. And they'll all fail and run down into the Pacific en masse, which would be an insult to the Pacific as has never occurred in the history of the world. So the first issue is they've got all these non-seismically qualified tanks that they're throwing up still at two a week. And those tanks then run the risk of a failure in a seismic event. The second thing, though, what TEPCO is doing is they're attempting to clean the water in the tank with filters. And they've been reasonably successful. You know, when they can do a tank, and there's so many tanks, there's still many they haven't gotten to, they can remove about 90% of the radiation from the tank. The radiation levels are still so high that if that tank were in any other country of the world, we certainly wouldn't think about releasing it into the Pacific. But considering how bad Fukushima is, the Japanese seem to consider that as, 90% is good enough. But the other half of that is that all of that radioactive material now is in filters, sitting in, like a Brita filter. When you take a Brita filter out of your sink, you can walk over to your trash can and throw that Brita filter into the trash can. Well, the filters that TEPCO's using now contain all of that radiation that was in the water. And it's not just cesium. Cesium's bad enough. These filters are going to have to be stored for 300 years somewhere. But because the nuclear core's melted down, what we've got now is strontium, which is a really bad chemical. It's a bone seeker that causes all sorts of cancers, but also plutonium. The nuclear reactor has breached and we're getting plutonium in the groundwater, which is now winding up in these filters. Well, plutonium stays radioactive for a quarter of a million years. And the Japanese are not being honest with their population. They're not telling them that, oh, by the way, in addition to these nuclear cores, whenever we find them, we've got thousands of filters that now have essentially pieces of the nuclear core in them that we're also going to have to store for a quarter of a million years. So by filtering the water, they've reduced the liquid problem, but they've created a huge solid radioactive waste problem that no one, you've got an exclusive here, Alex, and no one in the world is talking about where are they going to store all of these filters for a quarter of a million years.
A quarter of a million years, no problem. We should be able to look after them that long. Wow. Well, the Japanese press tells us the operator, TEPCO, plans to remove that temporary outer shell from the number one reactor. Is there a danger there?
Well, it increases the airborne radioactive releases. The reactor itself has been breached, and the reactor containment has been breached. Most of that breach is in the form of liquid radiation leaking out. But, you know, there's holes in the side of this thing that are continuously releasing gaseous radioactivity. So when they put that tent over top, that white tent over top of the building, that building was called the reactor building. It was designed to catch all those gases. And I can't figure out why they're doing it. They're basically allowing the airborne radiation that gets out to float freely throughout Fukushima Prefecture again. You know, it's nowhere near as bad as on the day of the accident, but if it were of an operating plant in anywhere in the world, the releases from that building would be called excessive and the reactor would be shut down. Of course, at Fukushima, there's a different set of rules in place.
Well, it's been a few years now since the big accident. We've heard almost nothing about the impacts on people in that region. There are accounts coming out of there of strange tumors, kids dying, pets dying. What have you heard, and can we ever expect an honest accounting from Japanese authorities?
But that's a pretty good summary, frankly. We continue to get information from people who live there about cancer rates and illnesses in general, not just cancer. Now, we think of radiation as a cancer-causing thing, but it also causes many other ailments. Much higher incidences of a whole range of illnesses than they had in 2010, the year before the accident. You know, we work with a woman who, she has a garden. She's an organic gardener. And every year she's taken the seeds from her garden, planted, and then harvested seeds from those plants to be the next year's crop. So she's got 4 years now of seeds that have been growing, you know, about 30 miles from Fukushima. And she's beginning to experience gargantuism in her food now, which is an indication of radiation damage. You know, it's one of the many DNA changes that occurs after a couple of generations. So we know that gardeners, and plants that are outside the exclusion zone are seeing the effects of chronic levels of radiation that the Japanese government would choose to ignore. We're also working with doctors in Japan, and some brave doctors are saying that they've been threatened, that their hospital rights have been threatened. You know, if you tell your patient this illness is radiation related, you'll lose your right to practice and things like that. So there's an enormous pressure on the medical community to tell the patients that what they're experiencing is not at all related to radiation. But, you know, the key is statistics, and the question is, when will the statistics be released for, mortality, morbidity, and general illnesses in Fukushima Prefecture? We're not seeing the data. The medical community now has to file every report that it writes with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, before it's issued. So if you're a hospital and you've got mortality data, you're not allowed to issue that to the public until those reports have been cleared by the IAEA. Well, Article 2 of the IAEA's charter is to promote nuclear power. So even if the hospital was conscientious, and of course there's a lot of political pressure not to be, but even if it was conscientious, there's another step in the process. And they've got to clear an IAEA hurdle before those numbers are released. It's truly frightening that the pressure that the medical community is undergoing in Japan, and very few of them are willing to tell the truth.
Reuters News Service reports that Japanese prosecutors are once again considering criminal charges against executives from Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO. Last year they said no charges, but a special citizens panel is forcing them to reconsider. And, you know, TEPCO's almost an invincible insider. That's their reputation. It's legendary in Japan. Is there any chance that those who should have known about this or could have known about this will be exposed to justice?
It's not could have or should have. They did know about it. There's no doubt about the fact that Tokyo executives in Tokyo knew about the magnitude of the crisis and stymied effective information being provided to the people. I won't go as far as say that the plant staff was involved. The plant staff acted heroically. I hope when it gets to the point of any indictments, that the members of the plant staff in a crisis situation were true heroes. But the people sitting on their in their easy chairs in Tokyo knew of the magnitude of the problem, should have evacuated earlier, you know, should have asked for assistance earlier, and should have alerted Prime Minister Khan earlier. You know, I had a talk with Prime Minister Khan last year. He and I were speaking in New York and then the next day in Boston. And I said to him, knowing what he knew from the two people who were providing him information, Tokyo Electric and METI, the industrial ministry where nuclear reports, he was getting awful information. And as a policymaker, he could not have gotten the information to evacuate from either of them. And the guy's not a nuclear engineer. So he did the best he could with some really miserable information and actually forced Tokyo Electric not to abandon the site. I'm absolutely convinced, and I've met with him several times about this, that Tokyo Electric was going to pull the plug, get out of the site, and let a meltdown destroy Japan. I hope people go to jail, but I'm not confident in the Japanese legal system. Their lawyers are very progressive, but their judicial system, their judges, are very conservative. And what happens, you know, you'll have a brilliant case get throttled by very conservative judges. And I don't know that that situation is going to get turned around anytime soon.
In another move, former Japanese Ambassador Mitsui Murata says Japan should back out of the 2020 Olympics. He calls it an honorable retreat, and that's because inviting international guests to a Tokyo still radioactive from the Fukushima disaster is, quote, immoral and unethical. Arne Gundersen, is Tokyo radioactive, and what are your thoughts about holding the Olympics there?
Yes, Tokyo is radioactive, and I've spoken to Ambassador Murata. And my problem is, if we worry about the exposure to Olympic athletes who are going to be there for 3 weeks, what about the exposure to the people who live in Tokyo for the last 10 years? You know, they'll, 9 years from 2011 till the 2020 Olympics. So I'm afraid it's a little bit elitist to worry about visiting athletes who are going to be there for 3 weeks, when in fact 35 million people are exposed to this radiation for 9 years. Now, I think the government of Japan should be aggressively cleaning up Tokyo, but to do so would spread fear, and that in turn would stop the Olympics, which would then crush a nuclear revival that the Abe regime is so it's so desirable to the Abe regime to get those nuclear plants running again. So I think, yes, Tokyo is contaminated, but my pity goes out to the 35 million people who live in it day to day, and the visiting athletes 6 years further on down the road are at low risk compared to the 35 million that have to live with it.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with nuclear expert Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds.com. And in just a minute, I'm going to ask you, Arne, about the facts and rumors about Fukushima radiation reaching the west coast of North America. Then we'll get to your new work on what could be the American Fukushima, the risky Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors in California. But I don't want to leave Japan, Arne, without this one glaring example of wishful thinking. Japanese regulators have ruled that there will be no volcanic eruption near Sendai nuclear plant during its last 30 years of operation. There was just a surprise eruption of Mount Ontake in central Japan this past September 27th. Expert volcanologists have protested nobody knows when volcanoes will go off. What does this sort of so-called planning tell us about the nuclear industry?
I think it's that general hubris that sets into the nuclear industry. You know, is it when you look at these plants, they're impressive pieces of concrete. And it must have been like standing in the dock watching the Titanic go out to sea. I mean, this was an impressive engineering feat. And we seem to forget the power of Mother Nature. I mean, you know, tsunami wall was 4 meters, but history showed that tsunamis of the magnitude that hit Fukushima, 15-meter tsunamis, happened less than every 1,000 years. Well, the same thing holds for earthquakes and volcanoes. You know, it's not like a volcano is going to pop up and 2 minutes before the plant has a chance to shut down, it's going to devour the plant. No one is suggesting that. But if the plant has to be abandoned, then you need to cool a nuclear reactor for 5 years because the radioactive material remains physically hot and radioactively hot for hundreds of years, but it remains physically hot for 5 years. So if a volcano were to erupt in the vicinity of the Sendai plants, the net effect wouldn't be the instantaneous failure of the plant, but it would result in abandoning the plant. And when you do that, you're unable to keep it cool. And you've got, you know, Fukushima all over again.
Okay, let's move over to North America. Now, this spring of 2014, a citizen in British Columbia, Canada, found a sample of cesium-134 in a park, and it was inland from the ocean. What would that tell us?
We have samples from Vancouver that show cesium-134 and 137 in gardens in Vancouver. So it didn't surprise me that you're finding 134 in inland regions. Cesium-137 has a 30-year half-life. And if that's all you find, you can't determine whether or not it came from Fukushima or from atomic bomb testing 30 or 40 or 50 years sooner. But when 134 is present, it has a 2-year half-life. So 134 is the signature that it came from Fukushima Daiichi. And like I said, we found gardens in Vancouver that had both cesium-137 and 134, which is a clear signature of Fukushima radiation. We've seen that as far north as a little bit north of Vancouver, all the way down to Portland, Oregon. That area, we've seen contaminated ground samples that have both 134 and 137. So clearly the West Coast was nailed in March and April of 2011. I don't think it's new contamination. I don't think 134 and 137 are continuing to fall on Vancouver or, you know, British Columbia or, you know, Seattle for that matter. But what you're finding now is the residual radiation that came over in those first waves, the first 2 months after the accident. Where it's most concentrated, Alex, is in the benthic fish, the fish that thrive on the bottom of rivers and ponds. If people really wanted to know if there were radiation, and governments don't seem to want to know this, the place to look is catfish, because catfish are bottom dwellers, and on the upstream side of dams, they are in water that's been trapped. You know, it's run out of the mountains and settles. All that sediment settles into the upstream side of dams. And if, you know, if the British Columbia government really wanted to look, the right thing to do would be to do some core samples on the upstream side of dams or to capture some catfish. Catfish would show strontium in their bones. And that's also another indication of Fukushima radiation. I don't know of any government, you know, Washington State, Oregon State, British Columbia, the city of Vancouver. I don't know of any government who's doing that kind of sampling. I don't think they really want to know the answer.
A Canadian research scientist named John Smith just told a meeting of the American Geophysical Union that his group has measured a radioactive plume from Fukushima in Canadian waters. Have you heard about that?
Yes, yes. There's also another plume heading a little bit further south down, you know, down the Oregon coast into California, yes.
So when is the real radioactivity expected to hit the West Coast, do we know?
You know, the plume is, we are not at the peak. It's still coming. And it will continue to come as long as Fukushima continues to bleed into the Pacific. So we're seeing the beginning of this concentration gradient, this flow of radiation. But the real issue is we get asked all the time, should I swim in the Pacific? And if you're brave enough, because it's awfully cold, swimming in this water is not a problem. We've had people say, should I run along the beach because I might inhale the air? The inhalation of this is not the problem. The problem is that the fish that live in that water bioaccumulate that material. So, you know, if there's, say, 10 becquerels per liter of cesium in the water, that's going to be what the fish then digest and concentrate. And then the little fish get eaten by the bigger fish and it works its way up the food chain. So the real issue is not swimming in the water, but it's eating the fish that are in the water. And, you know, I've made the personal decision not to eat fish from the Pacific anymore until I know the radiation concentration. You know, what I expect of my government, and I expect of the Canadian government as well, to tell me what's in that fish. And then as an informed consumer, I can make a decision about whether or not I want to eat it or not. But when I hear these platitudes from the United States that it's below safe levels, that's nice, but tell me the number. So as a informed consumer, I can make that decision. I don't want my government to make that decision for me.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with nuclear expert Arne Gunderson. Arne, it's like there's a terrible contest going on to see which could be the next American Fukushima. Vermont Yankees always in the running. Indian Point outside of New York City could have the biggest impact on the most people. But the two California reactors, San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, are the big contenders in my opinion. We know San Onofre was shut down, but there's still 1,600 tons at least of highly radioactive waste sitting on that earthquake zone. Do you feel confident the San Onofre nuclear waste is being safely stored?
Not yet. And by the way, we think of earthquakes as something that happens in California, but the plant with the highest, what we call core damage frequency, is actually Indian Point. It's only a mile away from a Richter 7.5 earthquake fault. That wasn't discovered until after it was built. So we could have an East Coast earthquake at Indian Point, which would be disastrous. But getting back to your question on San Onofre, if the material gets put into casks, the casks are much safer than the building they're in now. So my thought is the priority of officials should be to get that material out of the fuel pool and into casks as quickly as possible. The casks at Fukushima survived the earthquake and the tsunami just fine. It was the fuel pools that didn't. So until San Onofre, the fuel in the fuel pool is completely empty and it's in dry casks, then we still have a serious problem. Now, the choice of dry cask, there are better dry casks than they're presently using, but still in comparison to keeping that radiation in the fuel pool, wherever they put it in dry casks is better than where it is right now.
Okay, now the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactor, what are the multiple risks there in that double reactor complex right on the California coast?
Yeah, Diablo Canyon is in my mind, the most dangerous reactor in the United States. It was known when they built the plant that a Richter earthquake with ground accelerations of 0.4 G, 4/10 the acceleration of gravity, could hit the plant. And that's why they built it. Well, as they were building it, they discovered other earthquake faults that were much nearer to the plant that could double that to 0.75 G. And they didn't change the plant. They just changed the numerical analysis to make the plant fit an earthquake that was, you know, twice as severe. And what we found, Fairwinds just produced a report that we sent to the NRC. And the big thing they're ignoring is not the gross collapse of the building in the event of a Richter 0.7 G earthquake. It's something called instrument chatter. And it's really not spoken about very often in nuclear circles, but now hopefully Fairwinds can bring it to the forefront. You know, you have switches on on the wall that turn a light on. Well, they have switches in nuclear plants too. We call them relays. And if the ground shakes, the relay turns on and off without any human intervention. Now, we found an NRC report that shows that the NRC has said there's 100% probability that in the event of an earthquake, some of those relays are going to wind up in the wrong position. So if you want a pump to be on, the relay is going to be off. If you want a pump to be off, the relay is going to be on. because this relay chatter will cause them to bounce back and forth. And at the end of the earthquake, they won't be in the right position. And it's a really serious problem and has been unanalyzed at Diablo Canyon. In my opinion, Diablo Canyon should be shut down until they analyze that problem. But of course, that would be a 4 or 5 year effort, and they may as well throw in the towel. So they are choosing to ignore the problem rather than really analyze this relay chatter issue.
Well, this is the first I've heard of this. I guess we can say we're breaking this on Radio EcoShock.
You are. It's, it's in the deep bowels of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's files, but they don't want to talk about it either. People who work with relays have seen them buzz. You know, we'll be posting a video in the next couple of weeks about relay chatter. And they routinely will buzz when they're not working right, when the springs are worn and tired. They'll sit there and go, bzzz. Well, in the event of an earthquake, that will happen anyway, even if it's a brand new relay, because they'll just bounce. And the switches will turn on and off and on and off and on and off. And then when the earthquake ends, there's no guarantee they'll be where you want them to be.
And then we have David Lochbaum. He's a nuclear expert from the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says Diablo Canyon has never met the basic requirements for fire protection. Now, how can the NRC allow this nuclear plant to keep operating?
Well, it's happening in Region 4 of the NRC. And to my mind, Region 4 is the most industry-friendly region in the country. You know, Region 4 covers California, but all the way out essentially to the Mississippi River. We had Fort Calhoun, which was the plant that was surrounded by the Missouri River. That was a Region 4 reactor. We had San Onofre, which had, you know, gross failures of its steam generator. And if we let it to the NRC, they would have started that plant back up. And were it not for Friends of the Earth and the Fairwinds report that went with that, San Onofre would be running with damaged steam generators today. The NRC in Region 4 has never seen a nuclear reactor it doesn't like. And now, of course, you've got Diablo Canyon with miserable fire protection designed for an earthquake half the size as what geologists know it will encounter. And yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission continues to let it run. The concept is called grandfathering. And basically they say, once you've got your license, we're not going to take it away. You've been grandfathered in. If we find anything new, we won't make it apply to you. That's what's happened. The NRC has said, well, it was what was good in 1960 when this plant was designed is fine for it to continue to operate all the way until 2045 if Diablo Canyon has its way.
You can see the same thing happening in Japan about the height of the tsunami wall that they had there. You know, well, that's the height you build it, so we'll just let you keep operating. Now, this new report, is it going to be available online, and who did you do it with?
Yeah, we published about a 45-page expert report that was sent to the NRC a week and a half ago with a legal filing that was sponsored by Friends of the Earth. Basically, we determined that Diablo Canyon never should have been allowed to run because it violated a federal law. It's called 10 CFR 50. That's nuclear law, and it's Part 59, which basically says that when you know a plant has problems and you change your analytical approach to solve that problem, the public has a right to know it. That didn't happen at Diablo Canyon. The public was not informed that Pacific Gas and Electric, the owner of Diablo Canyon, made gross changes in all of the assumptions in order to get Diablo Canyon qualified to a much larger earthquake. The argument should have been made in 1980. Now Friends of the Earth is taking the argument forward in 35 years later.
Does the NRC have to respond? Do you expect them to?
I expect that they will. I don't know if they're on a clock. When the public finds a problem, we have to notify the NRC within 30 days or else we lose our right to complain. But when the NRC finds a problem, they can drag their feet for years. So I'm not sure when the NRC will respond. And I'm not optimistic that it'll be very quickly. Let's hope we can avoid an earthquake in the meantime.
Yeah, well, that's what the Japanese are hoping, too, with their volcanoes. Well, now this super dangerous San Onofre nuclear plant in California was finally shut down, mainly because the operator couldn't afford a third refit to fix that damaged piping and equipment. Is there any chance the operators of Diablo Canyon will finally shut it down? What could make it happen?
They should shut it down because it's not safe. Unfortunately, if we have to wait until the big one comes and then, wipe out the corridor between L.A. and San Francisco. Diablo Canyon is south of San Francisco, but north of L.A. on the coast. What could make it happen is renewables. I've been telling people, if you want to shut a nuclear plant down, put a solar collector on your roof, an electric solar collector. And why is that? Is that the nuclear plants don't make money at night. They lose money at night. They make money at the peak of the day, from essentially 11 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when the electric demand is highest, and that's when they can charge the most for their electricity. Well, if citizens like you and I and a million others put a solar collector on the roof, that's exactly when the peak power is for your solar collector, from about 11 until 3 o'clock. So citizens would offset that peak and make nuclear uneconomical at its peak, and in which case the owners would shut them down on economics. You know, follow the money, follow the money.
I like that. Solar power to kill off nuclear. Do you have other news, as we wrap up here, do you have other news from Fairwinds Energy Education that you would like to pass on?
Well, we just posted an incredible video just today. I gave a speech out in San Francisco at a conference called The Wave, W-A-V-E, and it was put on by Life Chiropractic, and there were 1,600 chiropractors from around the world, and I spoke about the four myths that have yet to be addressed as a result of the Fukushima Daiichi accident. It's a 20-minute speech, and we're running out of time, but if your listeners are interested, if they go to fairwinds.org and look up The Wave, they'll find the speech, and it's frankly, it's one of the most powerful speeches I've ever given, and I'd encourage people to listen to the unlearned lessons from Fukushima.
Yeah, it's lively. It's almost like a TED Talk, in my opinion. And I want to tell listeners that Fairwinds is spelled with an E. It's the old English spelling of fair, F-A-I-R-E, winds.com. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I first reported on Fukushima the day it happened with a series of emergency podcasts. My best source of information has consistently been our guest, Arnie Gunderson. Arnie, we all owe you and your partner Maggie a lot for your tireless work that you put into our nuclear safety. Thank you so much for helping us again on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex.
If you can afford to help me produce Radio EcoShock, I would appreciate your support now. Nonprofit radio stations and thousands of people around the world hear our authors and experts for free. No one pays me for this program. I don't have any secret foundation or corporate support. I depend on my listeners to pay the monthly bills. There is a small but hearty band of supporters who sign up for the $10 a month subscription. That's easy to do at our website at ecoshock.org/about. If you prefer, a donation of any amount is always greatly appreciated. Just click the donate button on our website or the blog. Hopefully I can raise enough this month to carry Radio EcoShock through the Christmas holiday season and into the new year. The point is to reach as many people as possible in all countries of the world. That's all I can do. If you can make a donation or take up a monthly membership, that leaves me free to concentrate on getting the best guests, doing the research, and distributing Radio EcoShock as widely as possible. Please consider a contribution. Details at ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. Remember, you can get links to everything we talk about in my weekly show blog, posted every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Post your comments at the blog. If you have tips or ideas for guests, contact me through our website at ecoshock.org or just write me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Next up, Naomi Klein. Naomi Klein is central to some of the great movements of our time. She's an intellectual activist. Her book, No Logo, became the anthem of the anti-globalization movement. The influential book, Shock Doctrine, brought disaster capitalism into our discourse. Her latest book couldn't be better timed. It's called This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Naomi Klein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
This program is broadcast by nonprofit stations outside the corporate system, and every one of those stations is struggling. It's hard to do anything without carbon money. And that's one of the reveals in your book. Some of the biggest and best known environmental groups get money from big oil or foundations built on fossil fuel wealth. Has the green movement been bought off?
Well, I think large parts of the green movement, particularly in the U.S., have definitely gotten much too cozy with fossil fuel interests, but that's really starting to change because we're seeing the emergence of a grassroots movement that is specifically taking on practices like fracking for natural gas, mining for tar sands bitumen, and this is creating a real shift within the green movement because this is the movement that's resonating with people. It's the same with fossil fuel divestment, which is really taking direct aim at the business model. So this is leaving groups like WWF that have, you know, long-term partnerships with Shell or the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, which have long relationships with oil companies, leaving them in the sense in the lurch. I mean, they still get their corporate money, but I think that this new generation of environmentalists know who their enemy is. They're going after the fossil fuel companies. They're not interested in forging partnerships with them. They understand that they have a business model that is at war with life on Earth. This is an industry with five times more carbon in their proven reserves than the atmosphere can absorb and leave us with a decent chance of keeping warming below catastrophic levels. So the science is very clear, the research is in, and a movement is responding accordingly.
I've changed my light bulbs, but we do need, as you say, large-scale plans to avert a climate disaster. But you know, Naomi, many representatives in the U.S. government don't believe in climate change, and in fact, they don't really believe in governing. How did that happen?
Well, the argument that I make in the book is that if we want to understand our collective failure to rise to this enormous challenge, the best explanation is historical bad timing, that this landed on our laps at the worst possible moment in our ideological evolution, and that movement is the late 1980s. 1988 is the year that James Hansen testified on Capitol Hill that he now had a high degree of certainty that there was a connection between greenhouse gas emissions and warming. That was the year that governments first met in Toronto, Canada, to discuss emission reduction. It was the year the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was formed. But 1988 was a fateful year for other reasons as well. It was the year that Canada and the U.S. signed the first free trade agreement that was extended into NAFTA and became the prototype for dozens of deals like it around the world. It was the year before the Berlin Wall collapsed. It was the moment that Francis Fukuyama declared history over. It was the most triumphant moment for the ideological project that told us exactly what you just said, that there's something wrong with governments governing, that they should just get out of the way and facilitate the rapid accumulation of profit. That's what those trade deals were all about. And we are familiar with the impact of these policies on our withered public sphere, on the collapse of the manufacturing sector, on the rise of gross income inequality. But one of the byproducts of this project has been the failure to deal with climate change, because it does require intervening in the market. It does require governing. It does require planning. And at the same time, this economic model is responsible for an emissions explosion. Because by liberating capital to the extent that we have, we didn't just make it easier for multinationals to scour the world for the cheapest possible labor, we also allowed them to scour the world for the cheapest and dirtiest energy, and that is coal.
With politics seeming to fail and the international climate negotiations not going anywhere, some of us yearn for green capitalists to save us. Tell us about Richard Branson, Virgin Airways, the Earth Challenge, and his $3 billion pledge.
Yeah, so I have this center of piece of the book is what I call magical thinking. And these are the stories that we tell ourselves to avoid confronting the reality that we need to change our economic system. And one is that the market will save us. One is that the billionaires will save us. And one is that technology in the form of geoengineering will save us. So in the book, I go through the various green billionaires that have told us that they will lead us to a new form of capitalism that does not have this conflict at its heart. And one of the most prominent of these billionaires is Richard Branson. And I spend a fair bit of time talking about his track record because I think it's really interesting and I think it's really telling. In 2006, he had an epiphany after Al Gore came to his house and gave him a personal PowerPoint presentation. He realized that he was a part of the problem as an airline magnate, and he wanted to be part of the solution. So he went to the Clinton Global Initiative, and he announced to much fanfare, much positive media coverage, that he was going to spend $3 billion over the next 10 years trying to come up with an alternative source of fuel, a carbon-neutral fuel, and fighting climate change. And this was, you know, a huge commitment. We hadn't heard of anything like it. What was most interesting about what Branson said is that he would divert 100% of the profits from his fossil fuel burning industries, those being his airlines and also his diesel burning trains, and spend all of the profits on coming up with the solution. He said if those industries weren't profitable enough, then he would find the money from other parts of his empire. So what my researchers and I did is just audit this. 8 years in, it's clear that we're nowhere near that $3 billion target. We're in the millions, not the billions. Branson has made it clear he doesn't intend to hit that target or anything close to it. And he says it's because he hasn't been profitable in this period. So what's interesting to me is that, you know, what has he been spending his money on instead of fighting climate change? Well, he's launched several new airlines, including Virgin America, including British domestic Virgin Airline and Australian domestic airline. And because of this, the emissions Virgin Airlines are up by 40%. So there's a couple things that I think are quite telling about this. One is that it shows that even the best-intentioned billionaire, if we're going to grant Branson that, and I don't see any reason not to, is trapped within this logic of infinite growth and competition. So even though he wanted to act, he still diverted his excess capital into launching new fossil fuel burning projects instead of fighting climate change. But the real reason I focus on Branson is because I actually think what he was articulating was a very good principle, which is a principle that used to guide environmental policy, which is polluter pays. Of course, it should be the industries that are burning the most fossil fuels, that are extracting the most fossil fuels, that should be delivering more of their profits to solving this crisis that they're knowingly fueling. But that's not going to be something that's going to happen out of the goodwill of individuals. It's going to have to be regulated as it was under, for instance, the Superfund Act, which was basically a levy imposed on toxic industries to help clean up the messes that they were creating. It was the principle behind getting the tobacco companies to help foot the bill for the ad campaigns, getting people to quit smoking and also paying the healthcare costs associated with smoking. So we need that model. And I think Richard Branson shows is that even many of the fossil fuel burning, big fossil fuel burning companies understand that this is sort of either they will volunteer it and sort of essentially use marketing to try to distract us, or they'll face real regulation. And I think another example of this is BP's Beyond Petroleum ploy, even earlier than Branson, when they announced that they had seen the light and they were not going to be a fossil fuel company anymore. They were going to be an energy company investing in wind and solar. And then a few years later, they changed their minds and decided that fossil fuels were too profitable, and they sold off many of their renewable energy holdings and have doubled down on some of the dirtiest fossil fuels, including tar sands.
You know, a recent Radio EcoShock guest read your book, and he immediately gave up any hope of a bottom-up revolution led by progressives like Naomi Klein. Is it too late for revolution?
Well, you know, I'm very clear in the book that we don't have a chance if we treat this as an issue that the environmental movement alone is going to address. Our only hope is if we recognize that this economic system that is fueling the climate crisis is also responsible for many other crises that are indeed more urgent and are more inclined to mobilize people, whether that's the inequality crisis or militarization of their communities, private prisons. I mean, this is the kind of thing that has people in the streets. So what I'm laying out in the book is a vision of climate justice uniting all of these other movements under a science-based deadline and a climate justice response that would fight inequality and bring jobs to communities and rebuild our ailing public infrastructure. But if we see it as a narrow environmental issue, then the idea of us responding in time at the scale that is required, I think that's clearly not going to happen.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, the influential author Naomi Klein. It seems to me that some climate activists do feel that we could take the carbon out of the equation, change our civilization, but we would still have Guantanamo, we would still have wars, we would still have many of the problems that you just elucidated. Why can't we just go directly for a climate solution only?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what we've been trying to do now since our government started negotiating in the late 1980s, and emissions are up by 61% since 1990. So the real question is, why would you think that by doing the same thing over and over again, you're going to have different results? That is precisely the theory of change that's been guiding the environmental movement, this very narrow carbon-based approach. And the track record is catastrophic. We're going backwards. It feels less likely in the current political climate. It's moved so far to the right that we could even get the most incremental policy shifts. So the argument I'm making is, let's try something different. Let's go deep. Let's try to shift the ideological pull. Let's have the ideological discussion that we've been systematically avoiding, that is obvious indeed to the right. This is why the right-wing climate deniers deny climate change, because they understand that if it's true, it challenges their whole ideological project.
Tell us about Blockadia. Is that a place? Where is it? When is it?
Well, Blockadia is a term that comes out of the movement against the Keystone XL pipeline. It's a phrase that anti-pipeline activists in Texas started using when they started using direct action to block the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. I use it in the book more broadly to describe this rising grassroots anti-fossil fuel movement that is fighting everything from mountaintop removal to fracking to tar sands pipelines to oil by rail to coal export terminals all along the Pacific Northwest. It's a spirit of drawing the line and saying that, you know, when you're in a hole, stop digging. And the last thing we need to be doing is putting in new fossil fuel infrastructure that's going to lock us into this model for decades to come. And in Canada, where I'm from, it's a movement that is very much led by Indigenous people, by First Nations people, whose rights have been affirmed by our Supreme Court many times, and who many Canadians now recognize are our country's greatest hope of resisting the extractivist economic model that guides our political elites.
I was going to ask you, Naomi, why the population question wasn't playing a bigger role in your assessment of Earth's problems. Then late in the book, I stumbled on your very personal revelation about having your own child in a world where children might bear an awful burden for our wasteful lifestyles. How do these difficult decisions for a woman, well, really for parents, relate to the great climate challenge?
Well, first of all, the reason I don't focus much on population as it relates to climate change is because I think it's a very, very politically fraught area. You know, I'm a feminist and I believe that every woman on the planet has a right to control her body and should have access to birth control. But I don't believe that because I don't see that as a climate solution. And I think it is dangerous when we shift the conversation away from consumption towards population, because the truth is that although population is a part of this, where population is growing most quickly, emissions are growing most slowly. Sub-Saharan Africa is where you see the largest population growth, and that's also the part of the world where emissions are lowest. People have kids largely because they're poor and they need kids to work in the field. When people have more money, they have fewer kids, but the problem is that we have an economic model that encourages a completely unsustainable level of consumption for those kids. So I think too often within the climate movement, there has been a tendency to shift the subject from the consumption of the wealthy to the procreation of the poor, and I didn't want the book to play into that.
You know, from the UK, our recent guest George Marshall said that the people least likely to talk about climate change are not Republicans, but young mothers. They can't bear to hear about the health impacts of pollution, much less a crazy weather system. From your own motherhood experience, how can we bring young mothers, potentially the most powerful group in the world, into the battle for a safe climate for our descendants?
Well, I actually think mothers are at the forefront of this movement. Women are at the forefront of this movement. It's one of the great tragedies of the way the environmental movement is structured is that some of its, you know, most of its most prominent spokespeople are white men, but most of the people who are on the front lines of the activism are women of color. And that's, you know, the movement, the Blockadia, you see that so clearly that it's so much driven by women who see a responsibility to protect water, to protect the air quality for their kids, for their communities. Women are at the forefront. And, you know, for me, I feel like we often neglect the emotional side of this crisis. So I open the book writing about how the hardest part for me is not reading the scary scientific studies, although that's scary. It's reading books to my toddler, reading board books to my toddler about animals that, you know, he's fascinated by and adores, and knowing that many of these animals are facing extinction. And I did that very deliberately because I think that it is important to speak and write personally. So to encourage other people to talk about that depth of fear. But I certainly don't agree that young mothers are least likely. My experience is that when there is a language that encourages us to make the connections and speaks to our deep fear as mothers, it encourages more women to participate in the discussion. That's certainly who's been responding most strongly to the book.
Okay. Now, and you've talked about reproduction. Near my home on the West Coast, the local pod of orcas, also known as killer whales, didn't have a calf in 2 years. They just had one and it died. The sea otters of Scotland can't manage to reproduce. It's not all climate change, is it?
No, it's not all climate change, but climate change tends to be a stressor. I mean, it puts all species under greater stress, and then they're more vulnerable to other diseases. So, you know, it's in many cases, there is a direct connection to the ability to reproduce and climate impacts. And one of the most direct is sea turtles, where just a marginal increase in the temperature level of the sand in which sea turtles bury their eggs can lead to those eggs not hatching, just cooking in the sand, or hatching overwhelmingly female. So that's just a very direct climate impact. There are many examples of this, often involving mistiming, where species, you know, are counting on there being abundant food sources for their young when they're born, and because they're falling out of step with those food sources. So I go through a lot of those examples in the book and talking about the Earth's own fertility crisis. But then there are lots of other examples where we are seeing impacts on fertility, and you can't draw a direct line, but climate is just layered on top of other environmental stresses that break down the immune system of different species and make them more vulnerable. And we're seeing that with orcas. We're seeing it with dolphins.
Well, as we wrap up, your book seems a chronicle of a struggle in the big world and inside yourself. Did you come out with the hope we can make it, or is just the dogged determination to keep on trying enough for now?
I mean, for me, I never see the question of whether or not, you know, we have a chance of this kind of necessary change in the face of an existential crisis as a sort of an odds game, a sort of like, you know, people often ask me, like, do we really have a chance, or how good is our chance? And it's, I feel like as long as we can see any chance, we have a moral responsibility to fight to increase that chance, to bring more people to this movement. And so long as there's any chance at all, then I'll be fighting for that chance and not doing sort of mathematical calculations on how great that chance is. There's still a chance, and that's all that matters.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest has been Naomi Klein, author of No Logo, Disaster Capitalism, and now This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. It's one of those books you need to read to be part of the action for change. Naomi, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, and thanks for all your work.
I'm Alex Smith. That's it for this week. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook. Subscribe to @EcoShock on Twitter. Look for our popular SoundCloud page. Get all our past shows as free MP3 downloads at the website ecoshock.org, or visit the weekly show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and caring about our world.